Want a more fault-tolerant data center? Bring the availability of cloud computing inside your data center with the only server built from the cloud up.
Greetings, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dan Stoltz, IT Pro Evangelist for Microsoft, and I'm here filling in for Bob Hunt, who has graciously turned over the reins for this TechNet Radio series. Today we have Jose Barreto as we take a look at Windows, at what's new in SMB in Windows Server 2012 R2. Thanks all for joining us on another episode of TechNet Radio focusing on SMB 3. You can access other posts in this series from aka.ms/SMB3series. You can find a ton of great technical information on Jose's blog. You can get there from the short link smb3.info. Hi, Jose, and welcome.
Hello there. How are things going?
Awesome. Thanks for joining us today. We really, really appreciate your wisdom. Can you start us off with a quick introduction of yourself?
Sure. My name is Jose Barreto, as you said, and I am a principal program manager with the File Server and Clustering Group. I guess technically now we're under the Cloud and Enterprise division. So, but we're still doing file server storage, Hyper-V over SMB, all that good stuff. So.
Awesome. I'm looking forward to getting into a lot of that awesome technology over the coming weeks and months as we continue this SMB3 series. Today's topic is really what's new in SMB in Windows Server 2012 R2. So let's start with just kind of an overview. It looks like SMB3 is, you know, changing the world of both networking and storage. So let's dive right into some of the different components. SMB3 offers new improved SMB bandwidth management. Can you share a bit with us about the three traffic types and how they're different?
Sure. Yeah. So the idea here is that we, in the R2 release, we had a 1 year time frame to go and work on some of the items that we introduced in Windows Server 2012. And bandwidth limitations is something that the bandwidth limits that we call it is essentially trying to curb certain types of traffic for Hyper-V, and it relates to our use of SMB for many things in the platform. So SMB used to be mostly for information worker traffic. Now we introduce Hyper-V over SMB traffic. Now we're doing live migration over SMB. And in those scenarios, on the network, it all looks like SMB. So it's very hard to differentiate the different types of traffic and say, okay, so for live migration, I want a limit. For Hyper-V over SMB, I want a limit that's different from that. And then I want to do something else for when I'm doing file copies. So this new capability is essentially you have three types of traffic, default, virtual machine, and live migration, and you can put a cap on any one of them or just one or two of them. And the idea is to handle these situations where you have different types of SMB flowing on the same network. So simple commandlet will get you set up for that.
Awesome. Excellent. SMB3 on R2 offers some new automatically rebalancing of scale-out file server clients. Can you tell us about this, you know, excellent technology for improving scalability and improving efficiency?
Yeah, so that's another thing. So we introduced the scale-out file server in 2012. And again, what we're doing here is we're refining it because in 2012, we can have between 2 and 8 nodes in a file server cluster. And when we say it's scale-out, it means that you can actually hit the same share from any of the nodes, right? And the notion is that the client would randomly connect to one of the nodes in the cluster, and that node will handle access for all activities coming from that client. Now, when we look at this in 2012, we saw that depending on the storage that you have in the back, there's a node that has the best access for a specific share. So let's say you're using mirrored store spaces as your storage. So the node that owns that volume can actually do I/O faster. If you hit that node, you have the best path to access the storage. Now, if you hit another node in the cluster, that's fine. We have typically very good connectivity between the nodes in the cluster, and we can redirect traffic. But we much rather avoid that redirection. Problem is, each share might hit a different mirrored space, and each mirrored space could be owned by a different node. So the whole notion is that we distribute those spaces. So if you have, say, 8 CSVs on a 4-node cluster, we guarantee that you're going to get 2 spaces on each node. Now, in order to make SMB work best in that configuration, we actually changed the SMB infrastructure so that you can hit for each share a different node. So this is new in R2, and it basically means that we'll get the shortest possible path, and the client will actually establish multiple connections to the same cluster in order to hit the best possible node for that specific share. So that's an interesting change there. It's optional. It helps us with moving of things around. So for instance, if you take a node down, and now you have fewer nodes, the CSVs rebalance and the clients will also rebalance. So there's a lot of automation there.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to really increase scalability and also greatly improve efficiency. If I could just ask one more question on that topic, how does that impact where you're trying to reroute to the server that's actually managing that underlying storage? If that server is overworked, how does that, you know, does that decrease your efficiency, or does that take away from the efficiency gain?
Yeah, it's an interesting angle, because now what we're asking you to do is, first of all, you should never have just one CSV in the whole cluster. So if you have 8 nodes and one CSV, that CSV is going to get owned by one of the nodes. That node will get all the traffic, all the 7 remaining nodes will do nothing. So there is a different sizing exercise and a different configuration that you have to handle there. So typically, if you have 4 nodes in a cluster, you want to have 4 CSVs at least. And you also want to make sure that you spread the load across those multiple CSVs. And you're right, if you have one CSV that's busier than everyone else, you'll end up with a node that's busier than everyone else. The nice piece about this is that Hyper-V has this great ability to do live storage migration, right? Mm. So if you find out that you created a CSV that's too loaded, you can actually at any time with the VMs running, move it from one share to another and rebalance that way. But at least with this ability, we now have, for a well-planned infrastructure, an ability to actually spread that load across in a more consistent fashion, right? Because before, we're kind of relying on round robin to kind of hit multiple nodes, and we could potentially be doing a lot of redirection in the back. So this way, we're overall more efficient, and there's less work for the admin to do, especially if the admin does a lot of the front work of planning in the right fashion. But you're right, you hit an interesting planning note that you now have to be careful with that.
Yep. So since we're talking about live migration a little bit in that answer, let me jump and talk a little bit about Hyper-V and live migrations over SMB, because to me, it's amazing the performance that we get out of it. I get tons of questions about the new capabilities. Can you enlighten us on some of these new capabilities, including SMB multi-channel and high-speed migrations with low CPU utilization?
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. So what happened is we did the 2012 release, and we showed how SMB can be so, not only fast from a sense of having high throughput, but also very low latency, right? Mm-hmm. And it's partially due to the way we now can aggregate multiple NICs through multi-channel. And it's a lot to do with how we leverage RDMA interfaces, which are these network interfaces that can do large memory transfers between machines. And for that, we actually completely abandon TCP/IP. We actually start with TCP/IP and quickly switch to a much more optimized transfer mode. And the Hyper-V guys were so impressed, right? And they came to us and say, you know what? we should actually do live migration with this, because live migration is actually not storage, right? I mean, there's storage migration, but what we're talking about here is the migration of the memory in a VM, right? And at first, they were saying, you know what? We can actually go and talk to the NIC directly and do this thing. And we talked to them and say, you know what? If you do this over SMB, you can actually leverage all the work that we did in 2012, like, for instance, the ability to have multiple connections for a single operation. So if you're actually doing a file copy over SMB in SMB3, right, we don't do a single TCP connection, even when we don't have RDMA. We do many, if possible, and that optimizes thing and things. And if you have multiple NICs, we use all at the same time. So they looked at it. They thought about doing it by themselves, but in the end, they just said, you know what? We'll just use SMB as a transport. And by doing that, they can actually reap all the benefits from our investment. And we actually did more investment in R2 in that regard as well. I'm not sure if you saw, but we have what was already one of the fastest solutions out there. We bumped it up by another 50%. In between 2012 and R2. So that's like crazy, improvement there. And they got all that. It is actually so fast that when we were doing testing of this, they had these very fast 56 gig NICs. And we put one of those and we went at full bandwidth, right? Then we put two times 56 gigs, so that's over 100 gigabits a second, and we saturated the full bandwidth. Then we put three of those, and then we hit an amazing 18 point something gigabytes a second on the memory transfer. Then we put the fourth NIC, and it didn't go any faster. And you're like saying, what's going on? We can't, I mean, come on, we're already kind of past 150 gigabits, but the folks were just putting all that they could, and mm-hmm. And you won't guess what was the limitation in that machine.
What was it?
Well,
bus speed.
The problem is that memory can only go up to a certain number, so we were actually operating as fast as the memory could operate. Mm. And DDR3 memory, if you go take a look at what it does about 18 gigabytes a second. That's what you can take out of that. So even if the network wasn't the bottleneck was just the ability to read and write memory from one system to the next. That for us was, the guys took a while to kind of troubleshoot to that. And they were like, and we were just laughing at it, saying, you know, that's really fast. We actually did a demo and we did migration of a 64 gig VM in just a few seconds, like 3 or 4 seconds. So that's amazing performance there, reaping the benefits of, you know, RDMA, doing very large I/O, very fast, and also multi-channel, because we're now combining these many interfaces at the same time. So
awesome. So some of our audience may not be familiar with RDMA and SMB over RDMA. My understanding is you were really offloading a lot of the work, a large majority of the work, to the network card and letting that do the management of it. And the CPU is doing very little, which gives you your reduced CPU load whenever you're doing these transfers. Can you go into a little bit more detail about RDMA or just talk in an overview of what RDMA is for those that may not already know?
Sure. So basically, when we were doing SMB3, we look at the networking technologies available to us, and pretty much everything that we looked at involved using TCP. So when you're doing TCP, essentially, you get all your data. Let's say you have 1 megabyte of data to transfer over the wire, right? And what we do is we have to chunk that into small pieces that are conforming to the TCP/IP protocol. Then you transfer that over to the other end, and on the other end you reassemble that 1 meg of data, and then we hand over to the workload, to the application or to whoever is requesting that information. With RDMA, we have a different way of behaving, but and what we do is, let's say, for instance, you want to read 1 megabyte of data from the file server. So on the file server side, we typically don't have a way to avoid that TCP overhead. But what we do now with RDMA is that we set aside a 1 meg buffer on the side that's going to receive that. We register that memory and we pass the request to read with a memory handle, if you will, a memory registration. And on the other end, the file server reads that data and the network interface places the 1 meg of data directly on the remote NICs memory. So essentially we have the two NICs making what RDMA stands for is remote direct memory access. So I'm actually accessing the remote memory directly. And that is done at the maximum throughput that the NICs can provide. There are multiple technologies that allow that to happen, and we implement it in a way that we can support the three most common implementations of RDMA. We have a few different NIC vendors that provide that. Now, the beauty of RDMA, as implemented by SMB, is that you don't have to do anything. So as a Hyper-V administrator, as a file server administrator, all you have to do is get the right NIC and put it in place, and the stack actually figures out if you do have it, if you don't. And if you have it, it will get used and things will go faster. If you don't have it, we'll continue to use TCP/IP and we'll make the best of it.
Awesome. And that's true if it's, you know, if you have RDMA on one NIC and not on the other, then the same is true. It just, it can't use it because it's not on both sides.
Yeah, and if you have multiple NICs of the same type and speed, on top of RDMA, we do what we call multi-channel, which is we use them both at once. And it's not like one file or one share here, one there. No, for a single copy, we'll actually send data on both channels at the same time. And if you have 2 1-gig NICs, you for a file copy, you get 2 gigabits of throughput. If you have, you know, whatever multiple of NICs you have, and you combine that with RDMA as well.
Yeah. You know, it just blows me away that we can, the rate at which we can move stuff across the wire now. It wasn't too long ago when, you know, you do some file copies on a server and you look at your network performance and you're at less than 10%. And now it just blows me away that the amount of bandwidth we can just, the amount of data we can just pump through the wires. So it's just awesome technology.
Yeah. And there are specific changes we made to copy in R2. That's actually, I think it's not even on the what's new article that we're using as a basis for this talk, which is we made some specific changes to optimize copy. So if you're doing an R2 to R2 copy of large files using SMB, we went in there and we optimized some of the chunks. So we're doing transfers in 8 megabyte chunks now to actually leverage the full ability of our pipe, our new interfaces and all that. So we see a lot of good benefit in file copies and regular Hyper-V or SMB.
Which means a lot less processing, a lot less overhead for header information and stuff like that. So that's awesome.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, I presume our audience knows what SMB is, but I just want to make sure. SMB, small message blocks, that's a protocol that's used for moving data across the wire. So it's not something that you have to go enable. It's just there. It's a technology, underlying technology that's being used by everything, right?
Yeah, SMB goes back 20 years or more, right? So it dates back to the 80s. Now, we have been evolving the protocol. I think the major change that we did in the 2012 release, where we made all these new, everything we talked about here, like the balancing, scale out, SMB multi-channel, SMB direct, are things that didn't exist prior to 2012. So we had this evolution happen over many years, mm-hmm. and we rewrote the protocol from scratch in 2008 when we did SMB2. And then we introduced a number of new features in 2012. So essentially, the protocol that we have today, you're still using the same fashion. It's, you know, /\ server name, /share name, as we did way back in the 80s. But what's happening behind the scenes, the protocol itself is dramatically different and much improved. And the kinds of speeds we're hitting today are just unheard of. Just a few years ago, we could only achieve that with, you know, fiber channel interfaces. And right. Now, port per port, I mean, we can do more on a single port than any fiber channel solution to date. And I'm hearing about new generation of fiber channel trying to come up, and it would just simply match something that we already do today. And we're already seeing some of the new interfaces coming up with 100 gig Ethernet and some of the new stuff coming up. Let it come. We're ready for it.
For
the,
sure.
The problem is if you're doing TCP/IP with some of these things, if you have to chunk 100 gigabits a second and reassemble on the other end, it gets very hard, right? So you need these kinds of technologies to actually leverage the full pipe when it gets that big. So we put some safe proofing in the protocol as well for the future of the technologies, right?
Yeah. Speaking of big chunks, VHDX files, you know, as a shared storage for guest clustering, greatly simplifies shared storage inside a virtual machine. Can you tell us a bit about how it works and, you know, what it is and how it works?
Yeah, this is an interesting feature. It was something that it's entirely new in 2012 R2. So this is all about guest clustering, right? So what we're trying to do here, say you have two VMs and you want to make a cluster out of the two VMs. Typical scenario is, say, for instance, you have a SQL database and you want to have two nodes, but you're all virtualized. So you actually, the nodes that you're creating the cluster with are actually not physical nodes, they're VMs. One of the things you have to create in order to have that solution implemented is you need to have some shared storage between the two VMs. So we had iSCSI for some time that can provide that shared storage to VMs, and we actually put a lot of effort in in creating this thing called Virtual Fiber Channel that also offers shared storage to the virtual machines. But the problem is, when you're doing these things, you're exposing your storage infrastructure to your guest. So your guest knows you're doing fiber channel or you're doing iSCSI. Mm-hmm. And you, in a sense, have to expose some of the infrastructure. What's great about virtualization is this ability, right, to mask what is the infrastructure that you're using in the back and just provide the simplified view of things to your VMs. So the notion there with the shared VHDX is when you want to actually share storage between two virtual machines, we introduce the notion that you simply say, I want to share this VHD file, right? So it has to be a VHDX. But essentially, when you create the VM, you say, okay, this VM uses this VHD to boot and this VHD for data. And by the way, this data VHD is shared. And on the other VM, you do the same thing. And this works for everything. It works for iSCSI. It works for fiber channel. It works for storage spaces. It works even with file shares. And essentially what you do is you give shared storage to the VM, and what the VM sees is a disk. It looks like a SAS disk, but it's obviously not a real SAS disk. It's a virtual SAS disk, and it's shared across the VMs. So now you can go create your guest clusters, and your VMs, your tenants running inside the VM, they have no idea what's the storage behind that shared storage. It could be iSCSI, it could be Fiber Channel, it could be anything. And the benefit there is that they have no way of actually trying to interact with that shared storage infrastructure. So they're shielded, they're virtualized, but they can create clusters. They can actually run the cluster validation as they would for any kind of storage, and it will pass. And you can go and create your clusters happily over there. And from a systems administration standpoint, it's such a simple solution to implement, and also much safer from the point of isolating the VMs from each other and providing sharing of storage when you decide to do it in a very straightforward way. So it's something that we heard a lot from customers that, you know, guest clustering was complex, virtual fiber channel was a lot of work to put in place, that iSCSI to the guest is something that didn't perform because it couldn't leverage some of our RDMA capabilities. And with shared VHDX, we have the best of both worlds. It's simple to implement, performs really well, and it works with anything.
Yeah, from a management standpoint, it can't get any easier, right? Just incredible.
Yeah, And it's actually, it works with live migration. It works across cluster nodes. So if you're doing guest clustering, right, you want to make sure that you can put the VMs in different nodes so that you are tolerant to the failure of a node. You can also do failovers in the storage side, right? So you can, let's say you have shared storage sitting on a file server, you can do the file server transparent failover. If you have CSV, you can move the CSVs around. So the principle here is offering high availability. So that's the beginning of things, but trying to keep things more manageable, more a little simpler to deploy. So
a couple other little kind of small things, I think. Well, small things for a lot of administrators, maybe not all of them, that I want to touch on. One is the fact that SMB1 is now an optional feature, so that can be disabled. Tell us a little bit about why we'd want to do that, and, you know, about that and why we'd want to do that.
Yeah, so I kind of mentioned that there's this very, very old version of SMB that
we talked about that.
That's decades old. So we don't use that for Hyper-V, right? So for Hyper-V, we are only using SMB 3 and up, 3 and 3.0.2, which is the R2 version. And we're encouraging everyone to use the latest version of the protocol. It turns out that we actually have separate stacks. So I mentioned that in 2008, mm-hmm. we rewrote the protocol. So we have this SMB 2 and 3 stack, which is an entirely different set of binaries. Right, but for compatibility reasons, we still have SMB1 there. So the old components, the SMB1 components, sit side by side with the SMB2.3 components. In this release, we actually did the work to separate them, and you have now a way using the feature management capability in PowerShell or in add remove features so that you can actually completely remove those binaries. So this is less maintenance. It reduces our security surface. And honestly, that is old stuff that you shouldn't be using anyway. Right? So if you're doing Hyper-V or SMB, for instance, there's no use for that SMB1 stuff there. So it's not used. Now, we have to still kind of acknowledge that XP is out there.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah.
What about 2003 or XP?
I know, 2003. You're right. That's SMB1 as well. So we need to keep it around. So it's on by default still. Mm-hmm. But we're sending a clear message to everyone that, you know, if you're running SMB1, you know who you are. And you should get ready. You should start moving to the new platform. So if you look at the Linux already supports SMB2. Mac OS with OS 10 Mavericks now has a built-in SMB2 support, which is now the preferred file protocol for Macs, right? Not AFP anymore, mm-hmm. not SMB1. And yeah, and we made the move back in 2008. So we're getting ready for that moment when we can finally and say, you know what, SMB1 is gone. So for now, if you're deploying for server workloads, Hyper-V over SMB, you can confidently just disable SMB1, reduce your surface. That's a good thing to do. If you're still servicing Windows XP or 2003 clients, you have to keep it around for a little more time, but the day's coming. We will soon be able to say, you know what, let's turn off SMB1 for good, and I look forward to
that. Days are numbered, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so lastly, and I'm not sure how many administrators are actually going to leverage this updated technology, but can you tell us a little bit about the improved SMB event messages?
Oh, that's just very important. That's crazy stuff that we did, and it's small, but it's so impactful, right? So. Mm-hmm. It's all about diagnosability. So we right. made changes in our events so that people can more easily parse what we mean when something goes wrong, right? So granted, I mean, we're doing stuff. We rely on DNS. We rely on networking. We rely on Active Directory and all these other components. When something goes wrong, you want to know which piece actually needs attention, right? And we sometimes had very, very, blunt error messages that provided no additional hints to what to do. So we went back and we look at our events very carefully to make sure that we tell people not only, you know, access denied, have a nice day, right? but also like access denied, there was a user called Joe who was trying to access this share that sits on this folder. He had these access credentials, but unfortunately, these credentials are required to access this share.
Right.
And you should take a look and grant the right permissions. And by the way, here's a pointer to where you find how to do these things. Right. So that's one example. The other one I like is the path not found.
Yep.
A path not found could mean I can't resolve the DNS name of this host, or I can resolve, but when I try to contact the host wasn't there, or the host was there, but the share you're mentioning isn't there. And there's a long list of things. So now we provide more information that not only gives you tidbits that are in memory at the moment of the error, and also some guidance, some human readable guidance on what to do for that kind of thing. And for certain events, we put an extra effort. So for instance, there are some events that when they happen only once, they mean something. When they happen many times in a row, that means something else. Uh-huh. So sometimes we say, oh, by the way, we had a network connectivity problem and we had to drop that connection. And by the way, this happened not so long ago, and at that time, this was the error code that we saw. So that you can actually tell, oh, this is a connection that's repeatedly dropping. Maybe there's a configuration error here, or something. So we're trying to give as much, as many hints as possible to what's the source, and some performance guidance as well. So sometimes people say, oh, I went to access this share, and it took a little while. So now we have an event that says, if the underlying storage is slow, we will actually log an error saying, oh, by the way, we're trying to read or write this data to the storage, and it's taking a few seconds, so you might want to look into that. Mm-hmm. So we want to make sure that everyone that's playing in the ecosystem gets the required tools to do troubleshooting. So that's a new focus that we put in SMB, in R2 specifically. There was actually a feature that we worked on quite a lot.
It's all about making our job easier, right?
Yes, the IT administrator sometimes doesn't get that much love, so we want to show the love.
For sure. Jose, thank you very, very much. I'm really, really, really looking forward to our next series, which will be in a couple of weeks. And until then, I will see you then. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.